This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Lexus and the Olive Tree by Thomas L. Friedman, narrated by George Wilson. This work is copyrighted 2000 by Thomas L. Friedman. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. And now, The Lexus and the Olive Tree.
Opening scene. The world is 10 years old. It's aggravating. We have nothing to do with Russia or Asia. We're just a little domestic business trying to grow, but we're being prevented because of the way those governments run their countries. Douglas Hanson, CEO of Rocky Mountain Internet Incorporated, speaking to the Wall Street Journal after the 1998 market meltdown forced him to postpone a $175 million junk bond issue. On the morning of December 8, 1997, the government of Thailand announced that it was closing 56 of the country's 58 top finance houses. Almost overnight, these private banks had been bankrupted by the crash of the Thai currency, the baht. The finance houses had borrowed heavily in U.S. dollars and lent those dollars out to Thai businesses for the building of hotels, office blocks, luxury apartments, and factories. The finance houses all thought they were safe because the Thai government was committed to keeping the Thai baht at a fixed rate against the dollar. But when the government failed to do so, in the wake of massive global speculation against the baht, triggered by a dawning awareness that the Thai economy was not as strong as previously believed, the Thai currency plummeted by 30%. This meant that businesses that had borrowed dollars had to come up with roughly one-third more Thai baht to pay back each $1 of loans. Many businesses couldn't pay the finance houses back. Many finance houses couldn't repay their foreign lenders, and the whole system went into gridlock, putting 20,000 white-collar employees out of work. The next day, I happened to be driving to an appointment in Bangkok down Asoke Street, Thailand's equivalent of Wall Street, where most of the bankrupt finance houses were located. As we slowly passed each one of these fallen firms, my cab driver pointed them out, pronouncing at each one, "Dead! Dead! 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 Dead!" I did not know it at the time. No one did. But these Thai investment houses were the first dominoes in what would prove to be the first global financial crisis of the new era of globalization, the era that followed the Cold War. The Thai crisis triggered a general flight of capital out of virtually all the Southeast Asian emerging markets, driving down the value of currencies in South Korea, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Both global and local investors started scrutinizing these economies more closely, found them wanting, and either moved their cash out to safer havens or demanded higher interest rates to compensate for the higher risk. It wasn't long before one of the most popular sweatshirts around Bangkok was emblazoned with the words, "Former Rich." Within a few months, the Southeast Asian recession began to have an effect on commodity prices around the world. Asia had been an important engine for worldwide economic growth, an engine that consumed huge amounts of raw materials. When that engine started to sputter, the prices of gold, copper, aluminum, and, most important, crude oil, all started to fall. This fall in worldwide commodity prices turned out to be the mechanism for transmitting the Southeast Asian crisis to Russia. Russia at that time was minding its own business, trying with the help of the IMF to climb out of its own self-made economic morass onto a stable growth track. The problem with Russia, though, was that too many of its factories couldn't make anything of value. In fact, much of what they made was considered negative value added. That is, a tractor made by a Russian factory was so bad, it was actually worth more as scrap metal, or just raw iron ore, than it was as a finished Russian-made tractor. On top of it all, those Russian factories that were making products that could be sold abroad were paying few, if any, taxes to the government. So the Kremlin was chronically short of cash. Without much of an economy to rely on for revenues, the Russian government had become heavily dependent on taxes from crude oil and other commodity exports to fund its operating budget. It had also become dependent on foreign borrowers, whose money Russia lured by offering ridiculous rates of interest on various Russian government-issued bonds. As Russia's economy continued to slide in early 1998, the Russians had to raise the interest rate on their ruble bonds from 20 to 50 to 70% to keep attracting the foreigners. The hedge funds and foreign banks kept buying them, figuring that even if the Russian government couldn't pay them back, the IMF would step in, bail out Russia, and the foreigners would get their money back. Some hedge funds and foreign banks not only continued to put their own money into Russia, but they went out and borrowed even more money at 5%, and then bought Russian T-bills with it that paid 20 or 30%. As Grandma would say, such a deal. But as Grandma would also say, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. And it was. The Asian-triggered slump in oil prices made it harder and harder for the Russian government to pay the interest and principal on its T-bills. And with the IMF under pressure to make loans to rescue Thailand, Korea, and Indonesia, it resisted any proposals for putting more cash into Russia, unless the Russians first fulfilled their promises to reform their economy, starting with getting their biggest businesses and banks to pay some taxes. On August 17, 1998, the Russian economic house of cards came tumbling down, dealing the markets a double whammy. Russia both devalued and unilaterally defaulted on its government bonds without giving any warning to its creditors or arranging any workout agreement. The hedge funds, banks, and investment banks that were invested in Russia began piling up massive losses, and those that had borrowed money to magnify their bets in the Kremlin casino were threatened with bankruptcy. On the face of it, the collapse of the Russian economy should not have had much impact on the global system. Russia's economy was smaller than that of the Netherlands, but the system was now more global than ever. And just as crude oil prices were the transmission mechanism from Southeast Asia to Russia, the hedge funds, the huge unregulated pools of private capital that scour the globe for the best investments, were the transmission mechanism from Russia to all the other emerging markets in the world, particularly Brazil. The hedge funds and other trading firms, having racked up huge losses in Russia, some of which were magnified 50 times by using borrowed money, suddenly had to raise cash to pay back their bankers. They had to sell anything that was liquid. So they started selling assets in financially sound countries to compensate for their losses in bad ones. Brazil, for instance, which had been doing a lot of the right things in the eyes of the global markets and the IMF, suddenly saw all its stocks and bonds being sold by panicky investors. Brazil had to raise its interest rates as high as 40% to try to hold capital inside the country. Variations on this scenario were played out throughout the world's emerging markets as investors fled for safety. They cashed in their Brazilian, Korean, Egyptian, Israeli, and Mexican bonds and stocks and put the money either under their mattresses or into the safest U.S. bonds they could find. So the declines in Brazil and the other emerging markets became the transmission mechanism that triggered a herd-like stampede into U.S. Treasury bonds. This, in turn, sharply drove up the value of U.S. T-bonds, drove down the interest that the U.S. government had to offer on them to attract investors, and increased the spread between U.S. T-bonds and other corporate and emerging market bonds. The steep drop in the yield on U.S. Treasury bonds was then the transmission mechanism which crippled more hedge funds and investment banks. Take, for instance, long-term capital management, based in Greenwich, Connecticut. LTCM was the mother of all hedge funds. Because so many hedge funds were attracted to the marketplace in the late 1980s, the field became fiercely competitive. Everyone pounced on the same opportunities. In order to make money in such a fiercely competitive world, the hedge funds had to seek ever more exotic bets with ever larger pools of cash. To guide them in placing the right bets, LTCM drew on the work of two Nobel Prize-winning business economists, whose research argued that the basic volatility of stocks and bonds could be estimated from how they reacted in the past. Using computer models and borrowing heavily from different banks, LTCM put $120 billion at risk, betting on the direction that certain key bonds would take in the summer of 1998. It implicitly bet that the value of U.S. T-bonds would go down, and that the value of junk bonds and emerging market bonds would go up. LTCM's computer model, however, never anticipated something like the global contagion that would be set off in August by Russia's collapse. And as a result, its bets turned out to be exactly wrong. When the whole investment world panicked at once and decided to rush into U.S. T-bonds, their value soared instead of fell, and the value of junk bonds and emerging market bonds collapsed instead of soared. LTCM was like a wishbone that got pulled apart from both ends. It had to be bailed out by its bankers to prevent it from engaging in a fire sale of all its stocks and bonds that could have triggered a worldwide market meltdown. Now we get to my street. In early August 1998, I happened to invest in my friend's new internet bank. The shares opened at $14.50 a share and soared to $27. I felt like a genius. But then Russia defaulted and set all these dominoes in motion, and my friend's stock went to $8. Why? Because his bank held a lot of home mortgages, and with the fall of interest rates in America triggered by the rush to buy T-bills, the markets feared that a lot of people would suddenly pay off their home mortgages early. If a lot of people paid off their home mortgages early, my friend's bank might not have the income stream that it was counting on to pay depositors. The markets were actually wrong about my friend's bank, and its stock bounced back nicely. Indeed, by early 1999, I was feeling like a genius again, as the Amazon.com internet craze set in and drove my friend's internet bank stock sky high, as well as other technology shares. But once again, it wasn't long before the rest of the world crashed the party. Only this time, instead of Russia breaking down the front door, it was Brazil's turn to upset U.S. markets and even dampen, temporarily, the internet stock boom. As I watched all this play out, all I could think of was that it took 9 months for the events on Asoke Street to affect my street. And it took 1 week for events on the Brazilian Amazon, Amazon.country, to affect Amazon.com. USA Today aptly summed up the global marketplace at the end of 1998. The trouble spread to one continent after another like a virus, the paper noted. U.S. markets reacted instantaneously. People in barber shops actually talked about the Thai bot. It wasn't long, though, before Amazon.com started to soar again, pulling up all the internet stocks, which in turn helped pull up the whole U.S. stock market, which in turn created a wealth effect in America, which in turn encouraged Americans to spend beyond their savings, which in turn enabled Brazil, Thailand, and other emerging markets to export their way out of their latest troubles by selling to America. Amazon.com, Amazon.country. We were all becoming one river. If nothing else, the cycle from Asoke Street to my street, and from Amazon.country to Amazon.com, and then back again to Amazon.country, serve to educate all of us about the state of the world today. The slow, fixed, divided Cold War system that had dominated international affairs since 1945 had been firmly replaced by a new, very greased, interconnected system called globalization. If we didn't fully understand that in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down, we sure understood it a decade later. Indeed, on October 11, 1998, at the height of the global economic crisis, Merrill Lynch ran full-page ads in major newspapers throughout America to drive this point home. The ads read, "The world is 10 years old. It was born when the wall fell in 1989. It's no surprise that the world's youngest economy, the global economy, is still finding its bearings. The intricate checks and balances that stabilize economies are only incorporated with time. Many world markets are only recently freed, governed for the first time by the emotions of the people, rather than the fists of the state." From where we sit, none of this diminishes the promise offered a decade ago by the demise of the walled-off world. The spread of free markets and democracy around the world is permitting more people everywhere to turn their aspirations into achievements. And technology, properly harnessed and liberally distributed, has the power to erase not just geographical borders, but also human ones. It seems to us that for a 10-year-old, the world continues to hold great promise. In the meantime, no one ever said growing up was easy. Actually, the Merrill Lynch ad would have been a little more correct to say that this era of globalization is 10 years old. Because from the mid-1800s to the late 1920s, the world experienced a similar era of globalization. If you compared the volumes of trade and capital flows across borders relative to GNPs, and the flow of labor across borders relative to populations, the period of globalization preceding World War I was quite similar to the one we are living through today. Great Britain, which was then the dominant global power, was a huge investor in emerging markets. And fat cats in England, Europe, and America were often buffeted by financial crises triggered by something that happened in Argentine railroad bonds, Latvian government bonds, or German government bonds. There were no currency controls, so no sooner was the transatlantic cable connected in 1866 than banking and financial crises in New York were quickly being transmitted to London or Paris. I was on a panel once with John Monks, the head of the British Trades Union Congress, the AFL-CIO of Britain, who remarked that the agenda for the TUC's first Congress in Manchester, England in 1868 listed among the items that needed to be discussed the need to deal with competition from the Asian colonies and the need to match the educational and training standards of the United States and Germany. In those days, people also migrated more than we remember, and other than in wartime, countries did not require passports for travel before 1914. All those immigrants who flooded America's shores came without visas. When you put all of these factors together, along with the inventions of the steamship, telegraph, railroad, and eventually telephone, it is safe to say that this first era of globalization before World War I shrank the world from a size large to a size medium. This first era of globalization and global finance capitalism was broken apart by the successive hammer blows of World War I, the Russian Revolution, and the Great Depression, which combined to fracture the world both physically and ideologically. The formerly divided world that emerged after World War II was then frozen in place by the Cold War. The Cold War was also an international system. It lasted roughly from 1945 to 1989, when, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was replaced by another system, the new era of globalization we are now in. Call it Globalization Round 2. It turns out that the roughly 75-year period from the start of World War I to the end of the Cold War was just a long time out between one era of globalization and another. While there are a lot of similarities in kind between the previous era of globalization and the one we are now in, what is new today is the degree and intensity with which the world is being tied together into a single globalized marketplace and village. What is also new is the sheer number of people and countries able to partake of today's globalized economy and information networks, and to be affected by them. The pre-1914 era of globalization may have been intense, but many developing countries in that era were left out of it. The pre-1914 era may have been large in scale relative to its time, but it was minuscule in absolute terms compared to today. Daily foreign exchange trading in 1900 was measured in the millions of dollars. In 1992, it was $820 billion a day, according to the New York Federal Reserve. And by April 1998, it was up to $1.5 trillion a day, and still rising. Around 1900, private capital flows from developed countries to developing ones could be measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and relatively few countries were involved. By 2000, it was being measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars, with dozens of countries involved. This new era of globalization, compared to the one before World War I, is turbocharged. But today's era of globalization is not only different in degree. In some very important ways, it is also different in kind, both technologically and politically. Technologically speaking, it is different in that the previous era of globalization was built around falling transportation costs. Thanks to the invention of the railroad, the steamship, and the automobile, people could get to a lot more places faster and cheaper, and they could trade with a lot more places faster and cheaper. But as The Economist has noted, today's era of globalization is built around falling telecommunications costs, thanks to microchips, satellites, fiber optics, and the Internet. These new information technologies are able to weave the world together even tighter. These technologies mean that developing countries don't just have to trade their raw materials to the West and get finished products in return. They mean that developing countries can become big-time producers as well. These technologies also allow companies to locate different parts of their production, research, and marketing in different countries, but still tie them together through computers and teleconferencing as though they were in one place. Also, thanks to the combination of computers and cheap telecommunications, people can now offer and trade services globally, from medical advice to software writing to data processing, services that could never really be traded before. And why not? A 3-minute call in 1996 dollars between New York and London cost $300 in 1930. Today, it is almost free through the Internet. These technologies are making it possible not only for traditional nation-states and corporations to reach farther, faster, cheaper, and deeper around the world than ever before, but also for individuals to do so. I was reminded of this point close to home when in the summer of 1998, my then 79-year-old mother, Margaret Friedman, who lives in Minneapolis, called me sounding very upset. "What's wrong, Mom?" I asked. "Well," she said, "I've been playing bridge on the Internet with three Frenchmen, and they keep speaking French to each other, and I can't understand them." when I chuckled at the thought of my card shark mom playing bridge with three Frenchmen on the net, she took a little umbrage. "Don't laugh," she said. "I was playing bridge with someone in Siberia the other day." To all those who say that this era of globalization is no different from the previous one, I would simply ask, was your great-grandmother playing bridge with Frenchmen on the Internet in 1900? I don't think so. But as I said, this new era of globalization is also different politically from that of the 1900s. That earlier era was dominated by British power, the British pound, and the British Navy. Today's era is dominated by American power, American culture, the American dollar, and the American Navy. American power after World War II deliberately set out to forge an open international trading system to stimulate employment and counterbalance Soviet communism. It was America that drove the creation of the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, and a host of other institutions for opening markets and fostering trade around the world. And it was the American fleet that kept the sea lanes open for these open markets to easily connect. So when the information revolution flowered in the late 1980s and made it possible for so many more people to act globally, communicate globally, travel globally, and sell globally, it flowered into a global power structure that encouraged and enhanced all these trends and made it very costly for any country that tried to buck them. In short, there are some things about this new era of globalization that we've seen before, but which are much more intense now, some things that we've never seen before, and some things that are so new we don't even understand them yet. For all these reasons, I would sum up the differences between the two eras of globalization this way. If the first era of globalization shrank the world from a size large to a size medium, this era of globalization is shrinking the world from a size medium to a size small. This book is an effort to explain how this new era of globalization became the dominant international system at the end of the 20th century, replacing the Cold War system, and to examine how it now shapes virtually everyone's domestic politics, commerce, environment, and international relations. In that sense, it is meant as a contribution to the body of literature that has been attempting to define the post-Cold War world. Among the most widely read of this genre are four books: Paul M. Kennedy's The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000, Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and The Last Man, the various essays and books of Robert D. Kaplan, and Samuel P. Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. While all of these works contained important truths, I think none of them really captured the post-Cold War world in any holistic way. Kaplan's reporting was vivid and honest, but he took the grimmest corners of the globe and overgeneralized from them to the fate of the rest of the world. Huntington saw cultural conflicts around the world and wildly expanded that into an enduring, sharply defined clash of civilizations, even proclaiming that the next world war, if there is one, will be a war between civilizations. I believe both Kaplan and Huntington vastly underestimated how the power of states, the lure of global markets, the diffusion of technology, the rise of networks, and the spread of global norms could trump their black and white, mostly black, projections. Both Kennedy and Huntington tried to divine the future too much from the past, and the past alone. Kennedy traced, quite brilliantly, the decline of the Spanish, French, and British empires, but he concluded by suggesting that the American empire would be the next to fall because of its own imperial overreaching. His implicit message was that the end of the Cold War not only meant the end of the Soviet Union, but would also herald the decline of the United States. I believe Kennedy did not appreciate enough that the relative decline of the United States in the 1980s, when he was writing, was part of America's preparing itself for and adjusting to the new globalization system, a process that much of the rest of the world is going through only now. Kennedy did not anticipate that under the pressure of globalization, America would slash its defense budget, shrink its government, and shift more and more powers to the free market in ways that would prolong its status as a great power, not diminish it. Huntington's view was that with the Cold War over, we won't have the Soviets to kick around anymore, so we will naturally go back to kicking the Hindus and Muslims around, and them kicking us. He implicitly ruled out the rise of some new international system that could shape events differently. For Huntington, only tribalism could follow the Cold War, not anything new. Fukuyama's pathbreaking book contained the most accurate insight about what was new, the triumph of liberalism and free market capitalism as the most effective way to organize a society. But his title, The End of History, implied a finality to this triumph, much more than the book itself does, that does not jibe with the world as I find it. In a way, each of these works became prominent because they tried to capture, in a single catchy thought, the one big thing, the central moving part, the essential motor that would drive international affairs in the post-Cold War world, either the clash of civilizations, chaos, the decline of empires, or the triumph of liberalism. My argument is different. I believe that if you want to understand the post-Cold War world, you have to start by understanding that a new international system has succeeded it, globalization. That is the one big thing people should focus on. Globalization is not the only thing influencing events in the world today, but to the extent that there is a North Star and a worldwide shaping force, it is this system. What is new is the system. What is old is power politics, chaos, clashing civilizations, and liberalism. And what is the drama of the post-Cold War world is the interaction between this new system and all these old passions and aspirations. It is a complex drama, with the final act still not written. That is why, under the globalization system, you will find both clashes of civilization and the homogenization of civilizations, both environmental disasters and amazing environmental rescues, both the triumph of liberal free market capitalism and a backlash against it, both the durability of nation states and the rise of enormously powerful non-state actors. What I have tried to write is a guidebook for how to follow that drama and how to think about managing it. Just one last word before we start. The publisher and editor of the first edition of this book, Jonathan Galassi, called me one day and said, "I was telling some friends of mine that you're writing a book about globalization." And they said, "Oh, Friedman, he loves globalization." What would you say to that? I answered Jonathan that I feel about globalization a lot like I feel about the dawn. Generally speaking, I think it's a good thing that the sun comes up every morning. It does more good than harm, especially if you wear sunscreen and sunglasses. But even if I didn't much care for the dawn, there isn't much I could do about it. I didn't start globalization. I can't stop it, except at a huge cost to human development. And I'm not going to waste time trying. I am a journalist, not a salesman for globalization. As you will see from the book, I am keenly aware of globalization's downsides. The question in my mind is what to do about them. I believe the best way for us to deal with the brutalities of globalization is by first understanding the logic of the system and its moving parts, and then figuring out how this system can benefit the most people while inflicting the least amount of pain. That is the spirit that motivated this book. The first part of the book explains how to look at today's globalization system and how the system works. The second part explains how nation-states, communities, individuals, and the environment interact with this system. The third part explains the backlash against globalization. And the fourth explains the unique role the United States plays and needs to keep playing in stabilizing this new system. Part 1. Seeing the System. Chapter 1. The New System. What was it that Forrest Gump's mama liked to say? Life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get inside. For me, an inveterate traveler and foreign correspondent, life is like room service. You never know what you're going to find outside your door. Take, for instance, the evening of December 31, 1994, when I began my assignment as the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. I started the column by writing from Tokyo, and when I arrived at the Okura Hotel after a long trans-Pacific flight, I called room service with one simple request. Could you please send me up 4 oranges? I am addicted to citrus, and I needed a fix. It seemed to me a simple enough order when I telephoned it in, and the person on the other end seemed to understand. About 20 minutes later, there was a knock at my door. A room service waiter was standing there in his perfectly creased uniform. In front of him was a cart covered by a starched white tablecloth. On the tablecloth were 4 tall glasses of fresh squeezed orange juice, each glass set regally in a small silver bowl of ice. No, I said to the waiter. I want oranges, oranges, not orange juice. I then pretended to bite into something like an orange. Ah, the waiter said, nodding his head. Oranges, oranges. I retreated into my room and went back to work. 20 minutes later, there was another knock at my door. Same waiter, same linen-covered room service trolley. But this time, on it were 4 plates, and on each plate was an orange that had been peeled and diced into perfect little sections that were fanned out on a plate like sushi, as only the Japanese can do. No, I said, shaking my head again. I want the whole orange. I made a ball shape with my hands. I want to keep them in my room and eat them for snacks. I can't eat 4 oranges all cut up like that. I can't store them in my minibar. I want the whole orange. Again, I did my best exaggerated imitation of someone eating an orange. Ah, the waiter said, nodding his head. Orange, orange, you want whole orange. Another 20 minutes went by. Again, there was a knock on my door. Same waiter, same trolley, only this time he had 4 bright oranges, each one on its own dinner plate, with a fork, knife, and linen napkin next to it. That was progress. That's right, I said, signing the bill. That's just what I wanted. As he left the room, I looked down at the room service bill. The 4 oranges were $22. How am I going to explain that to my publisher? But my citrus adventures were not over. 2 weeks later, I was in Hanoi, having dinner by myself in the dining room of the Metropole Hotel. It was the tangerine season in Vietnam, and vendors were selling pyramids of the most delicious, bright orange tangerines on every street corner. Each morning, I had a few tangerines for breakfast. When the waiter came to get my dessert order, I told him all I wanted was a tangerine. He went away and came back a few minutes later. Sorry, he said. No tangerines. "But how can that be?" I asked in exasperation. "You have a table full of them at breakfast every morning. Surely there must be a tangerine somewhere back in the kitchen." "Sorry," he shook his head. "Maybe you like watermelon?" "Okay," I said. "Bring me some watermelon." 5 minutes later, the waiter returned with a plate bearing 3 peeled tangerines on it. "I found the tangerines," he said. "No watermelon." Had I known then what I know now, I would have taken it all as a harbinger, for I too would find a lot of things on my plate and outside my door that I wasn't planning to find as I traveled the globe for the Times. Being the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times is actually the best job in the world. I mean, someone has to have the best job, right? Well, I've got it. The reason it is such a great job is that I get to be a tourist with an attitude. I get to go anywhere, anytime, and have attitudes about what I see and hear. But the question for me as I embarked on this odyssey was, which attitudes? What would be the lens, the perspective, the organizing system, the superstory, through which I would look at the world, make sense of events, prioritize them, opine upon them, and help readers understand them? In some ways, my predecessors had it a little easier. They each had a very obvious superstory and international system in place when they were writing. I am the 5th foreign affairs columnist in the history of the Times. Foreign Affairs is actually the paper's oldest column. It was begun in 1937 by a remarkable woman, Anne O'Hare McCormick, and was originally called In Europe, because in those days, In Europe was foreign affairs for most Americans, and it seemed perfectly natural that the paper's one overseas columnist would be located on the European continent. Mrs. McCormick's 1954 obituary in the Times said she got her start in foreign reporting as the wife of Mr. McCormick, a Dayton engineer, whom she accompanied on frequent buying trips to Europe. New York Times obits have become considerably more politically correct since then. The international system which she covered was the disintegration of balance of power Versailles Europe and the beginnings of World War II. As America emerged from World War II, standing astride the world as the preeminent superpower with global responsibilities and engaged in a global power struggle with the Soviet Union, the title of the column changed in 1954 to Foreign Affairs. Suddenly, the whole world was America's playing field, and the whole world mattered, because every corner was being contested with the Soviet Union. The Cold War international system, with its competition for influence and supremacy between the capitalist West and the communist East, between Washington, Moscow, and Beijing, became the superstory within which the next 3 foreign affairs columnists organized their opinions. By the time I started the column at the beginning of 1995, though, the Cold War was over. The Berlin Wall had crumbled, and the Soviet Union was history. I had the good fortune to witness, in the Kremlin, one of the last gasps of the Soviet Union. The day was December 16, 1991. Secretary of State James A. Baker III was visiting Moscow just as Boris Yeltsin was easing Mikhail Gorbachev out of power. Whenever Baker had met Gorbachev previously, they had held their talks in the Kremlin's gold-gilded St. Catherine Hall. There was always a very orchestrated entry scene for the press. Mr. Baker and his entourage would wait behind 2 huge wooden double doors at one end of the long Kremlin hall, with Gorbachev and his team behind the doors at the other end. And then, by some signal, the doors would simultaneously open, and each man would stride out, and they would shake hands in front of the cameras in the middle of the room. Well, on this day, Baker arrived for his meeting at the appointed hour, the doors swung open, and Boris Yeltsin walked out instead of Gorbachev. Guess who's coming to dinner? "Welcome to Russian soil and this Russian building," Yeltsin said to Baker. Baker did meet Gorbachev later in the day, but it was clear that power had shifted. We State Department reporters who were there to chronicle the event ended up spending that whole day in the Kremlin. It snowed heavily while we were inside, and when we finally walked out after sunset, we found the Kremlin grounds covered in a white snow blanket. As we trudged to the Kremlin's Spassky Gate, our shoes crunching fresh tracks in the snow, I noticed that the red Soviet hammer and sickle was still flying atop the Kremlin flagpole, illuminated by a spotlight, as it had been for some 70 years. I said to myself, that is probably the last time I'll ever see that flag flying there. In a few weeks it was indeed gone, and with it went the Cold War system and Superstory. But what wasn't clear to me as I embarked upon my column assignment a few years later was what had replaced the Cold War system as the dominant organizing framework for international affairs. So I actually began my column as a tourist without an attitude, just an open mind. For several years, I, like everyone else, just referred to the post-Cold War world. We knew some system was aborning that constituted a different framework for international relations, but we couldn't define what it was, so we defined it by what it wasn't. It wasn't the Cold War, so we called it the post-Cold War world. The more I traveled, though, the more it became apparent to me that we were not just in some messy, incoherent, indefinable post-Cold War world. Rather, we were in a new international system. This new system had its own unique logic, rules, pressures, and incentives, and it deserved its own name, globalization. Globalization is not just some economic fad, and it is not just a passing trend. It is an international system, the dominant international system that replaced the Cold War system after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We need to understand it as such. If there can be a statute of limitations on crimes, then surely there must be a statute of limitations on foreign policy clichés. With that in mind, the post-Cold War world should be declared over. We are now in the new international system of globalization. When I say that globalization has replaced the Cold War as the defining international system, what exactly do I mean? I mean that, as an international system, the Cold War had its own structure of power, the balance between the United States and the USSR. The Cold War had its own rules. In foreign affairs, neither superpower would encroach on the other's sphere of influence. In economics, less developed countries would focus on nurturing their own national industries. Developing countries on export-led growth, communist countries on autarky, and Western economies on regulated trade. The Cold War had its own dominant ideas, the clash between communism and capitalism, as well as détente, non-alignment, and perestroika. The Cold War had its own demographic trends. The movement of people from east to west was largely frozen by the Iron Curtain, but the movement from south to north was a more steady flow. The Cold War had its own perspective on the globe. The world was a space divided into the communist camp, the Western camp, and the neutral camp, and everyone's country was in one of them. The Cold War had its own defining technologies. Nuclear weapons and the Second Industrial Revolution were dominant, but for many people in developing countries, the hammer and sickle were still relevant tools. The Cold War had its own defining measurement, the throw weight of nuclear missiles. And lastly, the Cold War had its own defining anxiety, nuclear annihilation. When taken all together, the elements of this Cold War system influenced the domestic politics, commerce, and foreign relations of virtually every country in the world. The Cold War system didn't shape everything, but it shaped many things. Today's era of globalization is a similar international system with its own unique attributes, which contrast sharply with those of the Cold War. To begin with, the Cold War system was characterized by one overarching feature, division. The world was a divided-up, chopped-up place, and both your threats and opportunities in the Cold War system tended to grow out of who you were divided from. Appropriately, this Cold War system was symbolized by a single word, the wall, the Berlin Wall. One of my favorite descriptions of that world was provided by Jack Nicholson in the movie A Few Good Men. Nicholson plays a Marine colonel who is the commander of the U.S. base in Cuba at Guantanamo Bay. In the climactic scene of the movie, Nicholson is pressed by Tom Cruise to explain how a certain weak soldier under Nicholson's command, Santiago, was beaten to death by his own fellow Marines. "You want answers?" shouts Nicholson. "You want answers?" "I want the truth," retorts Cruise. "You can't handle the truth," says Nicholson. "Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives, and my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall." The globalization system is a bit different. It also has one overarching feature, integration. The world has become an increasingly interwoven place, and today, whether you are a company or a country, your threats and opportunities increasingly derive from who you are connected to. This globalization system is also characterized by a single word, the web. So in the broadest sense, we have gone from a system built around division and walls to a system increasingly built around integration and webs. In the Cold War, we reached for the hotline, which was a symbol that we were all divided, but at least two people were in charge, the United States and the Soviet Union. And in the globalization system, we reach for the Internet, which is a symbol that we are all increasingly connected and nobody is quite in charge. This leads to many other differences between the globalization system and the Cold War system. The globalization system, unlike the Cold War system, is not frozen, but a dynamic, ongoing process. That's why I define globalization this way. It is the inexorable integration of markets, nation-states, and technologies to a degree never witnessed before, in a way that is enabling individuals, corporations, and nation-states to reach around the world farther, faster, deeper, and cheaper than ever before, and in a way that is enabling the world to reach into individuals, corporations, and nation-states farther, faster, deeper, cheaper than ever before. This process of globalization is also producing a powerful backlash from those brutalized or left behind by this new system. The driving idea behind globalization is free market capitalism. The more you let market forces rule, and the more you open your economy to free trade and competition, the more efficient and flourishing your economy will be. Globalization means the spread of free market capitalism to virtually every country in the world. Therefore, globalization also has its own set of economic rules, rules that revolve around opening, deregulating, and privatizing your economy, in order to make it more competitive and attractive to foreign investment. In 1975, at the height of the Cold War, only 8% of countries worldwide had liberal free market capital regimes, and foreign direct investment at the time totaled only $23 billion, according to the World Bank. By 1997, the number of countries with liberal economic regimes constituted 28%, and foreign investment totaled $644 billion. Unlike the Cold War system, globalization has its own dominant culture, which is why it tends to be homogenizing to a certain degree. In previous eras, this sort of cultural homogenization happened on a regional scale. The Romanization of Western Europe and the Mediterranean world, the Islamification of Central Asia, North Africa, Europe, and the Middle East by the Arabs and later the Ottomans, or the Russification of Eastern and Central Europe and parts of Eurasia under the Soviets. Culturally speaking, globalization has tended to involve the spread, for better and for worse, of Americanization, from Big Macs to IMAX to Mickey Mouse. Globalization has its own defining technologies: computerization, miniaturization, digitization, satellite communications, fiber optics, and the Internet, which reinforce its defining perspective of integration. Once a country makes the leap into the system of globalization, its elites begin to internalize this perspective of integration and always try to locate themselves in a global context. I was visiting Amman, Jordan in the summer of 1998 and having coffee at the Intercontinental Hotel with my friend Rami Khoury, the leading political columnist in Jordan. We sat down and I asked him what was new. The first thing he said to me was, "Jordan was just added to CNN's worldwide weather highlights." What Rami was saying was that it is important for Jordan to know that those institutions which think globally believe it is now worth knowing what the weather is like in Amman. It makes Jordanians feel more important and holds out the hope that they will be enriched by having more tourists or global investors visiting. The day after seeing Rami, I happened to go to Israel and meet with Jacob Frenkel, governor of Israel's central bank and a University of Chicago-trained economist. Frenkel remarked that he, too, was going through a perspective change. Before, when we talked about macroeconomics, we started by looking at the local markets, local financial systems, and the interrelationship between them. And then, as an afterthought, we looked at the international economy. There was a feeling that what we do is primarily our own business, and then there are some outlets where we will sell abroad. Now we reverse the perspective. Let's not ask what markets we should export to after having decided what to produce. Rather, let's first study the global framework within which we operate, and then decide what to produce. It changes your whole perspective. While the defining measurement of the Cold War was weight, particularly the throw weight of missiles, the defining measurement of the globalization system is speed. Speed of commerce, travel, communication, and innovation. The Cold War was about Einstein's mass energy equation, E equals mc squared. Globalization tends to revolve around Moore's law, which states that the computing power of silicon chips will double every 18 to 24 months, while the price will halve. In the Cold War, the most frequently asked question was, "Whose side are you on?" In globalization, the most frequently asked question is, "To what extent are you connected to everyone?" In the Cold War, the second most frequently asked question was, "How big is your missile?" In globalization, the second most frequently asked question is, "How fast is your modem?" The defining document of the Cold War system was the treaty. The defining document of globalization is the deal. The Cold War system even had its own style. In 1961, according to Foreign Policy magazine, Cuban President Fidel Castro, wearing his usual olive drab military uniform, made his famous declaration, "I shall be a Marxist-Leninist for the rest of my life." In January 1999, Castro put on a business suit for a conference on globalization in Havana, to which financier George Soros and free market economist Milton Friedman were both invited. If the defining economists of the Cold War system were Karl Marx and John Maynard Keynes, who each in his own way wanted to tame capitalism, the defining economists of the globalization system are Joseph Schumpeter and Intel chairman Andy Grove, who prefer to unleash capitalism. Schumpeter, a former Austrian minister of finance and Harvard Business School professor, expressed the view in his classic work, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, that the essence of capitalism is the process of creative destruction, the perpetual cycle of destroying the old and less efficient product or service and replacing it with new, more efficient ones. Andy Grove took Schumpeter's insight that only the paranoid survive for the title of his book on life in Silicon Valley, and made it in many ways the business model of globalization capitalism. Grove helped to popularize the view that dramatic industry-transforming innovations are taking place today faster and faster. Thanks to these technological breakthroughs, the speed by which your latest invention can be made obsolete or turned into a commodity is now lightning quick. Therefore, only the paranoid, only those who are constantly looking over their shoulders to see who is creating something new that will destroy them, and then staying just one step ahead of them, will survive. Those countries that are most willing to let capitalism quickly destroy inefficient companies so that money can be freed up and directed to more innovative ones will thrive in the era of globalization. Those which rely on their governments to protect them from such creative destruction will fall behind in this era. James Surowiecki, the business columnist for Slate magazine, reviewing Grove's book, neatly summarized what Schumpeter and Grove have in common, which is the essence of globalization economics. It is the notion that innovation replaces tradition. The present, or perhaps the future, replaces the past. Nothing matters so much as what will come next, and what will come next can only arrive if what is here now gets overturned. While this makes the system a terrific place for innovation, it makes it a difficult place to live, since most people prefer some measure of security about the future to a life lived in almost constant uncertainty. We are not forced to recreate our relationships with those closest to us on a regular basis, and yet that's precisely what Schumpeter and Grove after him suggest is necessary to prosper today. Indeed, if the Cold War were a sport, it would be sumo wrestling, says John Hopkins University Foreign Affairs professor Michael Mandelbaum. It would be two big fat guys in a ring with all sorts of posturing and rituals and stomping of feet, but actually very little contact until the end of the match when there is a brief moment of shoving and the loser gets pushed out of the ring, but nobody gets killed. By contrast, if globalization were a sport, it would be the 100-meter dash over and over and over. And no matter how many times you win, you have to race again the next day, and if you lose by just 1/100th of a second, it can be as if you lost by an hour. Just ask French multinationals. In 1999, French labor laws were changed, requiring every employer to implement a 4-hour reduction in the legal work week from 39 hours to 35 hours, with no cut in pay. many French firms were fighting the move because of the impact it would have on their productivity in a global market. Henri Thierry, Human Resources Director for Thomson CSF Communications, a high-tech firm in the suburbs of Paris, told the Washington Post, "We are in a worldwide competition. If we lose 1 point of productivity, we lose orders. If we're obliged to go to 35 hours, it would be like requiring French athletes to run the 100 meters wearing flippers. They wouldn't have much of a chance winning a medal." To paraphrase German political theorist Carl Schmitt, the Cold War was a world of friends and enemies. The globalization world, by contrast, tends to turn all friends and enemies into competitors. If the defining anxiety of the Cold War was fear of annihilation from an enemy you knew all too well in a world struggle that was fixed and stable, the defining anxiety in globalization is fear of rapid change from an enemy you can't see, touch, or feel. A sense that your job, community, or workplace can be changed at any moment by anonymous economic and technological forces that are anything but stable. The defining defense system of the Cold War was radar, to expose the threats coming from the other side of the wall. The defining defense system of the globalization era is the X-ray machine, to expose the threats coming from within. Globalization also has its own demographic pattern, a rapid acceleration of the movement of people from rural areas and agricultural lifestyles to urban areas and urban lifestyles, more intimately linked with global fashion, food, markets, and entertainment trends. Last and most important, globalization has its own defining structure of power, which is much more complex than the Cold War structure. The Cold War system was built exclusively around nation-states. You acted on the world in that system, through your state. The Cold War was primarily a drama of states confronting states, balancing states and aligning with states. And as a system, the Cold War was balanced at the center by two superstates, the United States and the Soviet Union. The globalization system, by contrast, is built around three balances, which overlap and affect one another. The first is the traditional balance between nation-states. In the globalization system, the United States is now the sole and dominant superpower, and all other nations are subordinate to it, to one degree or another. The balance of power between the United States and the other states, though, still matters for the stability of this system, and it can still explain a lot of the news you read on the front pages of the papers, whether it is the containment of Iraq in the Middle East or the expansion of NATO against Russia in Central Europe. The second balance in the globalization system is between nation states and global markets. These global markets are made up of millions of investors moving money around the world with the click of a mouse. I call them the electronic herd, and this herd gathers in key global financial centers such as Wall Street, Hong Kong, London, and Frankfurt, which I call the supermarkets. The attitudes and actions of the electronic herd and the supermarkets can have a huge impact on nation-states today, even to the point of triggering the downfall of governments. Who ousted Suharto in Indonesia in 1998? It wasn't another state. It was the supermarkets, by withdrawing their support for and confidence in the Indonesian economy. You will not understand the front page of newspapers today unless you bring the supermarkets into your analysis. Because the United States can destroy you by dropping bombs, and the supermarkets can destroy you by downgrading your bonds. In other words, the United States is the dominant player in maintaining the globalization game board, but it is not alone in influencing the moves on that game board. This globalization game board today is a lot like a Ouija board. Sometimes pieces are moved around by the obvious hand of the superpower, and sometimes they are moved around by hidden hands of the supermarkets. The third balance that you have to pay attention to in the globalization system, the one that is really the newest of all, is the balance between individuals and nation-states. Because globalization has brought down many of the walls that limited the movement and reach of people, and because it has simultaneously wired the world into networks, it gives more power to individuals to influence both markets and nation-states than at any time in history. Individuals can increasingly act on the world stage directly, unmediated by a state. So you have today not only a superpower, not only supermarkets, but as will be demonstrated later in the book, you now have super-empowered individuals. Some of these super-empowered individuals are quite angry, some of them quite wonderful, but all of them are now able to act directly on the world stage. Without the knowledge of the U.S. government, long-term capital management, a few guys with a hedge fund in Greenwich, Connecticut, amassed more financial bets around the world than all the foreign reserves of China. Osama bin Laden, a Saudi millionaire with his own global network, declared war on the United States in the late 1990s, and the U.S. Air Force retaliated with a cruise missile attack on him, where he resided in Afghanistan, as though he were another nation-state. Think about that. The United States fired 75 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece at a person. That was a superpower against a super-empowered, angry man. Jody Williams won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her contribution to the international ban on landmines. She achieved that ban not only without much government help, but in the face of opposition from all the major powers. And what did she say was her secret weapon for organizing 1,000 different human rights and arms control groups on 6 continents? Email. Nation-states, and the American superpower in particular, are still hugely important today, but so too now are supermarkets and super-empowered individuals. You will never understand the globalization system or the front page of the morning paper unless you see it as a complex interaction between all three of these actors. States bumping up against states bumping up against supermarkets, and supermarkets and states bumping up against super-empowered individuals. Unfortunately, for reasons I will explain later, the system of globalization has come upon us far faster than our ability to retrain ourselves to see and comprehend it. Think about just this one fact. Most people had never even heard of the Internet in 1990, and very few people had an email address then. That was just 10 years ago. But today, the Internet, cell phones, and email have become essential tools that many people, and not only in developed countries, cannot imagine living without. It was no different, I am sure, at the start of the Cold War, with the first appearance of nuclear arsenals and deterrence theories. It took a long time for leaders and analysts of that era to fully grasp the real nature and dimensions of the Cold War system. They emerged from World War II thinking that this great war had produced a certain kind of world, but they soon discovered it had laid the foundations for a world very different from the one they anticipated. Much of what came to be seen as great Cold War architecture and strategizing were responses on the fly to changing events and evolving threats. Bit by bit, these Cold War strategists built the institutions, the perceptions, and the reflexes that came to be known as the Cold War system. It will be no different with the globalization system, except that it may take us even longer to get our minds around it, because it requires so much retraining just to see this new system, and because it is built not just around superpowers, but also around supermarkets and super-empowered individuals. I would say that in 2000, we understand as much about how today's system of globalization is going to work as we understood about how the Cold War system was going to work in 1946, the year Winston Churchill gave his speech warning that an Iron Curtain was coming down, cutting off the Soviet zone of influence from Western Europe. We barely understood how the Cold War system was going to play out 30 years after Churchill's speech. That was when Routledge published a collection of essays by some of the top Sovietologists entitled Soviet Economy Towards the Year 2000. It was a good seller when it came out. It never occurred at that time to any of the authors that there wouldn't be a Soviet economy in the year 2000. If you want to appreciate how few people understand exactly how this system works, think about one amusing fact. The two key economists who were advising long-term capital management, Robert C. Merton and Myron S. Scholes, shared the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1997, roughly 1 year before LTCM, so misunderstood the nature of risk in today's highly integrated global marketplace that it racked up the biggest losses in hedge fund history. And what did LTCM's two economists win their Nobel Prize for? For their studies on how complex financial instruments known as derivatives can be used by global investors to offset risk. In 1997, they won the Nobel Prize for managing risk. In 1998, they won the Booby Prize for creating risk. Same guys, same market, new world. Chapter 2. Information Arbitrage. At the wonderful Science Museum in Barcelona, I saw an exhibit that beautifully illustrated chaos. A non-linear version of a pendulum was set up so that the visitor could hold the bob and start out in a chosen position and with a chosen velocity. One could then watch the subsequent motion, which was also recorded with a pen on a sheet of paper. The visitor was then invited to seize the bob again and try to imitate exactly the previous initial position and velocity. No matter how carefully that was done, the subsequent motion was quite different from what it was the first time. I asked the museum director what the two men were doing who were standing in a corner watching us. He replied, "Oh, those are two Dutchmen waiting to take away the chaos." Apparently, the exhibit was about to be dismantled and taken to Amsterdam. But I have wondered ever since whether the services of those two Dutchmen would not be in great demand across the globe by organizations that wanted their chaos taken away. Murray Gell-Mann, author of The Quark and the Jaguar. Like everyone else trying to adjust to this new globalization system and bring it into focus, I had to retrain myself and develop new lenses to see it. In order to explain how, let me start with a confession that I have wanted to unburden myself of for a long, long time. Are you ready? Here it is. I used to make up the weather reports from Beirut. Well, actually, I didn't make them up. That would be wrong. I estimated them. It was 1979, and I was working as a cub reporter in Beirut for United Press International. I often had to work the late night shift, and one of the responsibilities of the late person was to file the weather report from Beirut, which would be included in UPI's worldwide weather roundup that went out to newspapers each day, with the highs and lows. The only problem was that there was no weatherman in Beirut, or at least none I was aware of. The country was in the midst of a civil war. Who cared what the temperature was? People were just glad to be alive. The only temperature you cared about in Beirut